If we're here, we might as well start talking about Joseph again. We've got Joseph revealed himself. The brothers are at first dismayed, but he gives them proof. The moving scene in verses 14 and 15, it says, he fell on Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck, and he kissed his brothers and wept over them. And after this, his brothers talked. I'll just point out that Middle Eastern custom, I believe even today, allows more physical contact between men than is customary, I know, in America. You know, I've never fell on someone's neck and wept on him and kissed him. So that's not, it might sound odd to our sensibilities, but it wouldn't be so unusual there. And just think of, you know, think of this as a cathartic experience, the release of tension. The brothers are finally relieved of decades of guilt for what they'd done. Now they don't have to feel guilty anymore. Joseph is finally ending, you know, about 20 years of being exiled from his family. So what a great thing. It's like, ah, finally relief. They're happy. It's no wonder tears came out and they're hugging and crying and, you know, such things. So it goes on. Now word gets around. Verse 16, the report of this was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying Joseph's brothers had come. It pleased Pharaoh and his servants well. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, load the animals and depart. Go to Canaan and bring your father and your households. Come to me. We'll give you the best of the land and you'll eat of the land. And Pharaoh even gave them carts, you know, wagons. Take your carts out of the land of Egypt for your little ones and your wives and come. And don't be concerned about your goods. The best of the land of Egypt is yours. So don't worry about your stuff. You can have everything here. One of the things this indicates is how much they appreciated Joseph's service in Egypt. You know, he was basically still in the process of saving them from famine and calamity. So what they'd done was so great that they had this wonderful appreciation. And it makes me wonder, you know, I still wonder if this Pharaoh were relatively young. And again, I don't have any proof. It's just something that's made me wonder. But if so, he might have looked at Joseph almost as a father figure. You know, he became maybe attached and like, wow, this great guy. And now his brothers are here and his dad can come. Whether or not that's true, you know, Egypt had strong feelings. I think of what's happened in our history that might relate. I think of the way Americans felt after the Revolutionary War towards George Washington. Everybody loved Washington more than hardly any leader we've had in the country since then. Although Franklin Roosevelt, after the Depression and World War II, was similar. And then in World War II, the way the Brits felt about Winston Churchill, they looked at him as the man who saved their country. And so they honored him a great deal. Kayla.
It said something about being a father to Pharaoh in verse 8. What was the reference there?
Well, there it is like, I've done these great things. Yeah, not that like literally it was his father or adopted him. But that supports the idea that Pharaoh might have looked at him as an older man, like a father figure. I put that in my notes. It reminds me. How many of you have visited London before? A few. Did you see that there's, I think it's near Westminster, there's a statue of Winston Churchill, bronze statue. I just love it because there he is, and most people recognize him, and it says just one thing, remember Winston Churchill. It's like it doesn't say Winston Churchill was born here and did this and this. It's like the presumption is everybody knows what he did, so remember him. You know, and I think of that way of thinking might have been the way the Egyptians felt about Joseph. At this time, we're only going to have to go a few pages later and we'll see the rise of a Pharaoh who it says forgot Joseph and later generations where they want to get rid of these Israelites. But for now, they're riding high. Yeah. Andrew?
Just a comment, and this may be a little far-fetched again, but this whole story, you know, how you compared like Jesus and Joseph, how he kind of treats us. I mean, we killed him, with our sin and did all these things, you know, to go against him, whatever. And then we see him again and, you know,
he welcomes us.
Yeah, he welcomes us. And then, you know, when he's talking about how they'll get like the best of the land and all of that, what we will one day get.
Yeah, that, well put. Okay, so they do what he says. They take their stuff and they go back. It says he sent each man changes of garments, but he's still showing favoritism to Benjamin. He gave him 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of garment. which I could sort of understand, but part of me says, is this family ever going to learn to stop showing favoritism? Because it tends to work for bad, but I think they're all doing pretty well. So he sent his brothers away. They departed. He says, see that you don't become troubled on the way. Or that could be translated like, don't get lost. You know, take care of yourself. You know, get there in one piece. They went up to Egypt, came to the land of Canaan to their father, and they said, hey, Joseph's alive, and he's governing all the land of Egypt. And it says Jacob's heart stood still. We think that means he fainted. You know, there's various guesses, but, you know, his heart might have literally skipped a beat, but because later it says he revived, so he might have just been in shock, and I can easily picture him just fainting dead away. But he revives, and they show him some evidence. They probably told him the whole story, and they said the words that Joseph had said. He saw the carts, and his spirit revived, and Israel said, it's enough. If Joseph, my son, is still alive, I'll go and see him before I die. So Joseph is committed, you know, that he wants to go do this. Not a motivation. Remember, you know, Jacob's 130 years old at this time. You know, I've got an 82-year-old father-in-law, and it's hard for me to get him. I can't get him to travel north of the Ohio River except on rare circumstances. And older people don't like to travel, but Joseph says, okay, I'm going to go. And remember, he's also got to overcome not only maybe an older man's desire to not have to travel a long ways. Remember what God had told Isaac. Many years ago, it seems, when there was a famine and Isaac was minded, maybe I'll go down to Egypt. The reference is in chapter 26, verses 2 and 3. God told Isaac, don't go to Egypt. Stay here and I'll take care of you. So if Jacob was familiar with that, he might have been thinking, oh, should I go to Egypt? And I think God was familiar, because we'll see early on in the next chapter that God will speak to Jacob personally and tell him it's okay to go to Egypt. So they're doing that. In verse chapter 46, Israel took his journey and all that he had and came to Beersheba. That's on the way from Hebron to Egypt, and it's a significant place. And Beersheba continues to be a significant place. That's where God had appeared to Isaac in chapter 26, verse 23. Abraham had offered sacrifice there in 21, verse 33. And now we're about to see here is where God will appear and speak to Jacob. So Beersheba, and remember, it's the southern area. It's on the way towards Egypt. As a matter of fact, it's the next verse. God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night. Jacob, Jacob, here I am. I'm God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. He's already had the promises. You're going to have descendants like the stars for multitude. You're going to have all these riches. God's saying that's where it's going to happen. That's where I'm going to make you a great nation. And he says, I'll go down with you to Egypt, and I'll surely bring you up again. And so he's basically, I'm going to take you to Egypt. I'll bring you out again. Now, that's, you could say, speaking of his body, because Jacob is going to die there, and it seems he probably, maybe he has that idea, but he would have his body brought back and buried. But he says, Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. That's our first indication that Jacob might be sharing the difficulty with vision that his father Isaac had. And matter of fact, Isaac was probably about that age or so. Remember when Jacob put the goat skins on his arms and said, I'm Esau, because Isaac couldn't see well enough to tell him apart. There's an indication perhaps Jacob is getting that. And we'll see that come up a little bit later. So Jacob arose, this is verse 5, from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives with the carts. So they took their livestock and their goods that they had. So they didn't leave everything behind. They took as much as they could. And they went to Egypt. And now, let me turn my page to see if I missed something. Because starting in verse 8, we get a long listing of names. Chapter 8, or verse 8 through 27, and I'm not going to read them all. I'm sure I'd mispronounce a large number of them anyways. But this is a listing of the male descendants of Jacob that went to Egypt. So I'm sure they had daughters too. And I'm sorry, ladies, that society at that time didn't count the women in the genealogies, which I'll stop and make the point again. In the genealogy of Jesus Christ, 5 women are mentioned, and it reminds us of how different and outstanding that is and why we give special attention to those women. But here it lists 66 names, I actually did count them at one time, but not this time, but I'm pretty sure it's still true. Okay, later it'll say there were 70. Okay, the way we get to 70 is we have 66, we add Jacob himself, 67, then Joseph, Manasseh, and Ephraim, who are already there, and that gives us the 70. So the 70 descendants of Jacob includes Jacob himself. Now I'm going to point out something you might not have thought of or cared about, but in Acts chapter 7, verse 14, Acts 7 is the chapter that has the famous speech by Stephen the martyr when he's on trial and he gives this long history, and then later they're so angry. Well, at the end he says, I see the Jesus standing at the right hand of God, and so they stone him. But in Acts 7, verse 14, it says 75 people. Does the Bible contradict itself? Well, no, it doesn't. Good answer. I'll point out why we think there seems to be a discrepancy. The reason is actually the Septuagint translation says 75. Remember, the Septuagint was a Greek translation of the Old Testament, and that's what most people used at the time of Christ. And it says 75, we believe, because it includes five sons born to Ephraim and Manasseh. So this version includes Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh. We learn later, and actually you can see it in 1 Chronicles 7, verses 14 through 20, that they had sons. So the Septuagint version seems to account them too and say there were 75. Stephen, we know, would have been familiar with that. And for our purposes, it doesn't matter at all. But just to, again, to so we can be assured, the Bible doesn't contradict itself. There's an explanation for some of these subtle differences we sometimes see between the Old Testament and New. And it seems like the big majority of the time, the reason is because they were looking at a Greek translation and names get shifted a little bit and things like that. Okay, having said that, let's go down to verse 28. Okay. Oh, it's at the bottom of verse 7. All the persons of the house of Jacob who went to Egypt were 70. That's including some who were already there. And he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point the way before him to Goshen. So Judah is again playing a role, a responsible role. But it's also worth noting it was very prudent to send a messenger to the government to let them know, we've got a large number of people entering your country. If there were 67 men, there were probably at least 67 women, and that's not counting servants. So, as I said, this could have been as many as 200 people come traipsing into the country. That looks like a small army. So you send somebody ahead and say, hey, it's just us. We're the guys Joseph invited. So Judah's the one that does that. And then verse 29, Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father and presented himself and fell on his neck and wept a good while. That Joseph, he's always crying. But that's not a bad thing. I'll point out, the land of Goshen, we believe, is up here in the Delta. And Joseph is probably at the capital somewhere upriver quite a ways. Some scholars have said, you know, from Hebron to Goshen might have been a shorter trip than Joseph had to make to go visit them. And again, that's not anything that's a big deal, but it's worth noting Joseph is showing proper respect to his father by going to him, not asking Jacob to travel upriver, you know, to see Joseph, even though Joseph has this high government position and he could have required that. And verse 30, Israel said to Joseph, now let me die, since I've seen your face and you're still alive. That probably doesn't mean Jacob wants to die. What he means is I've accomplished my greatest life's goal, you know, so I could die a happy man. So, and I think most people read it that way. It doesn't imply that he wants to die. And it'll turn out that he'll live another 17 years. We'll be able to see them, add the numbers up later. So Joseph said to his brothers and fathers, I'm going to go tell Pharaoh and say, my brothers, you know, that you're here, and tell him that the men are shepherds. Their occupation has been to feed livestock. So it'll be when Pharaoh calls you and says, what's your occupation? You'll say, we've been with livestock, you know, our fathers till now. So please let us dwell in the land of Goshen. Goshen was considered very good land, probably because it's far enough north, they say that it probably was getting rainfall as well as relying on the flood of the Nile. So when the when the Nile's not flooding, apparently Goshen still might get some rain. It's still suitable. It's not the best farmland, but apparently was very good pasture land, which makes perfect sense. Okay, let us, you know, bring our flocks and herds there. Why in the world do the Egyptians abhor shepherds? At the end of the chapter, it says, every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. We know the Egyptians did have livestock. You know, we see that referenced a little bit here, and we see it in Exodus. So there's some guesses as to why. One is that there were roving bands of, we could call bandits, you know, bandidos, or I think the VeggieTales version calls them desperados, but that's just so they can make a joke on the song lyrics. But a lot of them, you know, look like shepherds because they're wandering around and they have livestock. So one guess is, oh, they're equating shepherds with these roving no-goods that rip off caravans. Another more prominent theory is that we know at some point in Egyptian history, there was a group of outsiders that conquered and ruled Egypt, and they were called the Hyksos. Hyksos, and it's translated to mean shepherd kings, or king shepherds, depending on how you look at it. I just read Josephus going at it in some detail. So there are various theories of where the Hyksos fit into the story of the Bible. You could say some people would say, oh, it was a Hyksos ruler that accepted Joseph, and then later the Hyksos were kicked out, and that's why they forgot Joseph. Some people say it's the other way around. The true Egyptians welcomed Joseph and he saved them, and when the Hyksos came in, they didn't recognize the Israelites. And some people equate the Israelites themselves with the Hyksos. So there's some mystery about that. But the whole thing that it was shepherd kings who seemed to be invaders, if that's extent here, that might be a reason the Egyptians think of shepherds as being an abomination. Boy, that was a long way to get there. Okay, another possible reason, and I've only got three, so this is the last one, is shepherds tend to eat the thing that they're shepherding. And there were some animals that perhaps shepherds routinely ate or sacrificed that were sacred to the Egyptians. Kind of like in India today, still most people won't eat beef because they believe cows are sacred in some way. So we think it's something, could be been something like that. But all of these I'm presenting as possibilities. We just don't know for sure. But again, the Bible is not throwing something out there that's ridiculous and couldn't be true. You know, history will support the Bible if you look at it properly. That's a long way of getting to that. Okay. Questions? It's also worth noting in all this, Joseph wanted to emphasize his family's work as shepherds, so that they would get to live in Goshen, which is the proper, you know, best place for them. And of course, that's where they would multiply. I'm just mentioning that because there's speculation, and again, it's speculation, but I think it's probably true that since the Israelites, you know, traveled around in this area, they probably engaged in merchant, you know, buying and selling. You know, because they're on this major conjunction of three continents, major trade route. If you live on a major trade route, why wouldn't you engage in some trade? I guess that's a way to put it. But they didn't want to talk about that. They want to settle in Goshen. So the emphasis, don't tell them about the trade. Tell them you're shepherds. And that's sort of me reading into that again. Okay, now I want to go on to chapter 47. Joseph went and told Pharaoh, so Joseph is showing proper respect and deference to Pharaoh as his ruler. So he goes, you know, even though, you know, later he says, I'm like a father to Pharaoh, he goes to Pharaoh and he says, my father and my brothers, flocks and herds are here. They're in the land of Canaan. And he brings a delegation. He chooses five men from among his brothers and presents them to Pharaoh. We don't know which five. Some people think maybe he just took the five oldest, Reuben, Simeon, Levi. You know, or some people say one from each of the four mothers, and then who is the fifth position? And we don't know. Some people even speculate Jacob himself. We know Pharaoh is going to meet Jacob, but that doesn't explain why he said from his brothers. Another case where we don't have to know. If we did, it would say it. But Pharaoh asks them, "What's your occupation?" And they answer the way Joseph said, "We're shepherds and our father, you know, both we and our fathers. We've come to dwell in the land because we have no pasture, you know, for our flock. Now let us dwell in Goshen." And Pharaoh says, "Yeah." He spoke to Joseph, "Your father and your brothers have come, the land of Egypt before you. Have them dwell in the best of the land." Keeps reminding us, Goshen is not second best. It's not, well, put them over in the corner out of the way. Gives them a really good place for their livestock. In verse 7, "Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh." There's something we don't know exactly what that means. He might have just said, "God bless you, son," or, but some have speculated, did Pharaoh let him put hands on him and pronounce a blessing? Again, I suspect it's more something like just saying, "God bless you," than something like that. Pharaoh is impressed by his age. Like I said, Pharaoh's like, "How old are you?" Which is one of the things that makes me think the Pharaoh might have been relatively young. Jacob says, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." Boy, that's a long way of getting around to saying, yeah, I didn't live as long as my dad did, but I'm pretty old. I was looking at that time, Jacob was 50 years younger than Isaac was when he died. So remember, Isaac lived to 180. So no wonder Jacob is saying, yeah, I'm not living as long as my dad. He makes it sound like, you know, few and evil have been my years. Like, oh, what a rough life. No, but they weren't all bad, were they? I mean, there was some bad. He had to run for his life from his brother. His father-in-law cheated him. You know, he got engaged to one woman and found himself married to another. And all this stuff happened. He's afraid to death that Esau was going to come with an army and killed him. But there are a lot of good. You know, he'd overcome his faults. He developed a proper relationship with God. And by the way, he became incredibly wealthy and had a large family. So Jacob is sort of showing humility and downplaying a situation, but it wasn't really that bad. Again, it says he blessed Pharaoh. We can speculate about what that means. Verse 11, Joseph situated his father and brothers, gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, and the best of the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Note here, it says the land of Ramses. This I'll point at. Remember that documentary, Patterns of Evidence, that we watched? It makes the point that some historians and Bible scholars say, okay, Ramses had to be the Pharaoh of the Exodus because it says they're in the land of Ramses. But I'm glad that the documentary says, no, that wasn't such a rare name. It could have been named the land of Ramses long before the Pharaoh named Ramses. And that the fact that the name shows up here is supportive of that. I won't say that it's conclusive evidence, because we know that Moses put the book of Genesis together later on, and he could have inserted the modern name. But I don't think that being in the land of Ramses necessarily ties them to the lifespan of a pharaoh named Ramses. So I thought I'd stop and comment on that. Joseph provided for his father and brothers. So Joseph is in charge of all the grain. He's allowed to, you know, provide all the food they need. He doesn't have to charge them for it. And now much of the rest of the chapter goes on to describe basically how Joseph provides for Egypt. It's a bit of administration that we don't have to read all of, but it's worth us knowing that Joseph knew how long the famine was going to last. You know, he interpreted the dream. There's going to be 7 years of famine. There's been two so far. There's five left. Did everybody else know that? No. Some people might have. I don't know if Joseph was keeping it a secret, but there's indication maybe they didn't know because they keep coming back, you know, and he works out a different deal. I think it's worth noting because the way Joseph does this is increasing Pharaoh's power and decreasing that of other people. So first he lets the people buy the grain. You know, so Pharaoh and his government is getting all the money. You know, he's getting a bunch of money. People are buying grain. And then they come back and say, well, we're out of money, but you don't want to let us starve here in front of you and you watch us die because we can't buy food. So he says, well, I'll take your livestock. So all the livestock is traded in. Now that belongs to Pharaoh. And now another year comes by and say, okay, we're still starving. You know, take us. We'll sell ourselves into slavery, both us and our land. And Joseph, okay, you are, the whole, everybody belongs to Pharaoh. Everybody except who? Anybody read it in advance that remembers? Oh, I'll tell you then. The priests, Pharaoh gives them food. He doesn't take their land or make them pay for it. So, and we don't know what kind of priests they were. I'm sure they're not true priests. It's not Melchizedek that's down there. These are pagan priests of whatever the weird religion that the Egyptians have. But Pharaoh provides for them. But he basically is going to take ownership of everything else. And so he owns the people and the land. This brought to mind something I came across in studying European history, because you've heard of peasants and serfs. Back in the Middle Ages, that was common. You know, Russia, before the Communist Revolution, had pretty strong absolute rulers, the czars, and most of the population were serfs or peasants. And it's interesting, at one point, they in an address to the czar said, yeah, we belong to you, but the land belongs to us. I thought that was an interesting distinction. They're telling the czar, yeah, you own me, but I still own the land, which I'm not sure what difference that makes. But here we see Pharaoh is claiming to own all of it. And as we saw in that documentary, this might be how Pharaoh greatly increased his power. He already had a lot of power, but there might have been nobles and different, you know, people with position and wealth and influence, but now their land belongs to Pharaoh. He's got their money. He's got their livestock. And when a monarch can claim to own everything, people don't have property rights. They can't object to paying taxes. And it'll tell us, sorry, I'm looking for where Joseph sets up a tax. Yeah, in verse 24, it says, it'll come to pass in the harvest that you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh, four-fifths will be your own as seed for the field, your foods. And they said, well, you've saved our lives. Let us find favor. So, in other words, Pharaoh can just decide what the tax is. That's a little different than we have in our countries, right? I say our country, we got several here. I know the way it is in the U.S. and Britain. Matter of fact, the U.S. designates only the House of Representatives can initiate a new tax. You know, we believe in what we call rule by consent of the governed. But it took a while to develop into that. Sorry, this is off Bible, but you might be familiar. It's funny, they say if you study history, there's three or four dates you have to know, and all the rest you can just look up. But 1066 is one of those dates, if you're doing Western history. And you don't have to know it for this class, but anybody remember what happened in 1066? Jan?
William the Conqueror conquered Anglo-Saxon England.
Yeah, William the Conqueror goes across the English Channel from northern France, from Normandy, and conquers all of Britain. And of course, that's a new era in British rule. But one thing that's important, when he did this, he made a very strong claim. He conquered it and said, I own it. All the land belongs to me. He did something similar to what Pharaoh was doing, except he didn't use a famine. He just claimed it by right of conquest. And thus, he had a very great power. He could rule as a very strong monarch. And British monarchs for many generations did so. And British history is an interesting story of, over time, Parliament gradually working to take back some of that power. And you've heard of the Grand Charter, Magna Carta, thank you. I was just trying to think of the Latin. When they forced King John or Prince John to sign that. But, and then actually it's caught up with the story of American history, because while we think of the American Revolution as a conflict with the king, it's actually bound up with a struggle between the king and Parliament for who has this control. And I'm going far afield of biblical history, but I'm showing that the forces we see in the examples in ancient history are not unique. They've happened over time, and things like that have been repeated. And here, you know, the government takes advantage of an opportunity to wrest this power and would use it for a long time. And of course, a few generations later, when God wants to free Israel, he'll have to break that power. but it's still a very strong power, and it takes great miracles from God to overcome it. Of course, God could have done it any way he wanted, but boy, I went far afield there. But I'm sort of setting the stage for what's going to come in the next book. Let's note in verse 27. So Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there, and they did what? They grew and multiplied exceedingly. So the rapid birthright of the Israel, not birthright, birth rate of the Israelites was already underway. So remember, Israel was one guy. He talks about how I crossed the river with just my staff, and when he came back to the promised land, he was two bands. Now it's up to 70 people, and they keep on having kids. This will be referenced in Exodus 1, verse 7. It also talks about him. Matter of fact, how does it phrase there? There's one place where it seems to say it several ways. Yeah, it does. Exodus 1, 7, the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty. It's like they're having kids all over the place, you know. They say it all these different ways, but it starts right away. And it's not considered a problem at first. Where was I? In verse 27, okay. And the end of the chapter, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So was the length of Jacob's life, 147 years. So that helps us see the time frame. He's 130 when he comes in. He's going to be there 17 more years. So the story is going to jump ahead to the end of Jacob's life. And when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Now if I found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please don't bury me in Egypt." Where have we seen that putting the hand under the thigh thing before? Yeah, when Abraham sent a servant of his to find a wife for Isaac, remember, put your hand under my thigh. And I speculated what, you know, there's different interpretations of what that means. But all of them end up, you know, at least allude to the person putting himself in a very vulnerable position and the other person doing something that was probably a little awkward and uncomfortable. But it's enough to say, this is serious. You get in this position, this is an oath that you're not going to forget or take lightly. What does he want him to promise by putting his hand under his thigh? "Don't bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me in the burial place." And he said, "I'll do as you've said." And he said, "Swear to me." So he swore to him, and Israel bowed himself on the bed. So we see I suspect this might be two separate incidents. One at the end of chapter 47, and then again at the beginning of chapter 48, where Joseph comes to see Jacob. I'm not absolutely certain of that. Perhaps they're telescoped and it was one trip, because we're still at the end of Jacob's life. There couldn't have been much time between them. But in one, Joseph, basically Jacob's saying, "Take me back home to bury me." Where is he going to be buried, Matt? I think it's near Hebron, but it's a burial place we know. Remember after Sarah died and Abraham met with the Hittites, the sons of Heth, and he bought the cave and he had to buy the whole field with it. But Sarah was buried there. Then Ishmael and Isaac buried Abraham there. Then Esau and Jacob buried Isaac there, and Rebekah was buried there, and later we'll see Leah is buried there. So we're going to see the patriarchs and their wives in this one place. So Jacob wants to be in that place. Yes. You guys that spend time in Israel, that's where they say the place is, the cave of the patriarchs. I didn't realize that. That makes sense. But so they've got them as relics in all the Catholic churches throughout Europe, right? And I've got the finger of Stephen the Martyr or something weird like that. Don't look at me. I didn't make that stuff up. And there's so many pieces of the cross, I've heard, that you could build the ark out of them all if you brought them together. So a lot of people claim they've got a piece of the true cross, but there's more wood than could have possibly been in it. But still, people like their artifacts and relics. Where was I going with this? I wouldn't mind. I wanted to get at least through chapter 47. We can actually. There's a very important thing we'll see here in chapter 48, because chapter 48. It came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, "Your father's sick." So he's apparently not there. He gets a message, "Hey, your dad's sick," and that's a message none of us want to get. But at some point in our lives, we often do, or we're more sad if we don't. All right, just brought back to memory. I was at college when I got a letter from my sister telling me, "Mom is not doing well." And I called her up and said, if you want to see her again, come home right now. I mean, so sometimes you get that kind of a message. So Jacob goes. One thing I'll add, if you skip from there to the beginning of chapter 49, it says, Jacob called his sons and said, gather together. So we'll go back and go through what's in chapter 48, but I suspect that the message went to all of the sons, perhaps all the sons and grandsons, Jacob's six. So it's not just Joseph, but we're going to deal with Joseph first. And I imagine all of them coming to the house, and Joseph is called in first, and he brings Ephraim and Manasseh with him. But the other brothers are there waiting for their turn, and they're all going to come in, you know, probably in this one afternoon or whatever it might be. So he does, he takes his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, and Jacob says, look, your son, or he was told, Joseph is coming. Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. So he's in his sick bed. He knows his life is about to end. He gathers his energy and he sits up. He might have put his legs over the bed, so he's prepared to meet with his son and grandsons. And Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said, I'll make you fruitful and multiply you and make you a multitude of people and give you this land to your descendants as an everlasting possession. And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. Now, it might just sound like he's being figurative. Yeah, your sons are my sons. But he goes out of his way to do a bit more. He says, as Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Your offspring who you beget after them will be yours, but they're going to be called by the name of their brothers. And actually, there's no evidence in the Bible that Joseph ever had any other kids. And I don't know why, but he had Ephraim and Manasseh. And the terminology we use is Jacob is now adopting them legally. You're not my grandsons anymore. You're in the position of my sons. Like Reuben and Simeon. What's the significance of Reuben and Simeon? Why didn't he name just any two sons? They are the two oldest, the firstborn and the secondborn. So in essence, Jacob is giving Joseph the birthright. He's saying, I'm adopting your two sons, because remember what comes as part of the birthright? I think I listed two definite things and one possible. Okay, you receive twice as much of the inheritance. Okay, that's literally going to happen. Where there was one son, Joseph, now there's two tribes. So Joseph literally gets a double portion by Jacob adopting, you know, these two. I want to make a point now. You know, Deuteronomy 21, verses 15 to 16, addresses this. Now, Deuteronomy 21 hadn't happened yet, and it's part of the civil law given to Israel. So you could make the case it doesn't apply. What does it say? It says a father, if he has more than one wife, can't make the son of the wife he loves the firstborn and get the birthright over someone else who was the real firstborn. And it seems to describe this situation. Reuben was the true firstborn, and Jacob's saying, I'm going to give it to Joseph instead. Is there a legal reason why how could Jacob have done this and not be running afoul of the law, assuming that law would be in place? Sky seems to know.
Vaguely recall you talking about how Reuben had done something to lose the birthright?
Yes, I did say something. Let me show you, because it's not just inferred. If we turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 5, you can keep a hand here. 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verses 1 and 2 explain exactly what happened. Because the first several chapters of Chronicles is a lot of names. It's all this genealogy, which I'm guessing you guys will probably skim right over that in former prophets class because it's dull reading. But this is interesting. The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, says he was indeed the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that the genealogy is not listed according to birthright. So here it clearly gives the legal explanation. Reuben didn't lose the birthright because Jacob loved Joseph better, but Reuben had committed a sin, or you could even say a crime. He went up to his father's couch. Is that one? Yeah, oh, defiled his father's bed. That doesn't mean he crawled in bed with his dad and accidentally wet the bed that night. No, it's talking about the incident with Bilhah. You know, after Rachel had died, Bilhah was free, and Reuben is now grown enough that he went and had unlawful intercourse with his father's wife. He did something grievously sinful, and that cost him the position of the birthright. And I'm making the point that Jacob had cause to do this that wasn't just, I like him better than you. We know he did like Joseph better, but the legal reason is Reuben committed this act that was sinful and criminal, and it cost him the birthright. It's given to Joseph, so the birthright went to Joseph, and through his two sons, Joseph had a double portion. And Jacob says, they're mine. Matter of fact, we go back to Genesis 48, he'll say a bit more about it. In verse 6, your offspring you beget after will be yours. They'll be called by the name of their brothers and their inheritance. But as for me, when I came from Padan Aram, Rachel died before me. Oh, yeah, okay, sorry, I was looking past the poetry. It's in verse 16, as part of the blessing, where Jacob says, let my name be named on them. And verse 16, the angel who's redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, let my name be named upon them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, let them grow into a multitude of the earth. So that's another thing we put a significance on. He's adopting them, they get the birthright, and he specifically says, put my name on them. That seems to fit the idea of adoption as well, but in God's church, we've looked at that and said, we spend a lot of time studying end-time prophecy, and those end-time prophecies are often talk about Israel. Jacob's name was Israel, and what I'm getting at is a lot of times we'll read these prophecies, and you've heard me and others do it, say, this in the modern times pertains to the U.S. and Britain, the English-speaking peoples. Well, that's because we believe that the English-speaking peoples were descended from Ephraim and Manasseh, and we put it here where Jacob said, let my name be on them. So perhaps in prophecy where you see the name Israel, it might be named on Ephraim and Manasseh, so prophecy specifically referring to those peoples. Is that making sense? And I'm guessing most of you at least have heard this before. It's not a new thing in the church, but I like to show it. We get it from the Bible. You know, we've taught this for decades. We don't emphasize it as much these days, partly because we don't really have to. The prophecies still are easy to connect. But we had a reason for saying sometimes it says Israel, it means Ephraim and Manasseh and their descendants. We'll come back. I want to fill in. I don't want to just skip ahead to the end of the chapter.